Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Estás escuchando The Fifth Floor.
The Fifth Floor'ı dinliyorsunuz. Bizimle kalın.
Tumya Ektay, The Fifth Floor, Farnak Amidi Sobat.
This is The Fifth Floor, at the heart of global storytelling with BBC journalists from all around the world. I'm your host, Farnak Amidi. Here on The Fifth Floor, we want to get to know our multilingual reporters who are truly living the stories they cover a little bit better. And that's why sometimes we get so close that we end up in their kitchen.
So I'm making soy sauce chicken today. It's one of my absolute favorite childhood dishes from Singapore.
And we are starting this episode with Shayna Oppenheimer in her kitchen in Israel.
My mom makes it for me because her mom used to make it for her, and it's just this kind of slow cooked chicken with dark soy sauce, some nice star anise, little caramelized sugar, and lots and lots and lots of ginger. So yeah, this ginger, I went to three different stores to find it today. It's not really the quality I would like it, but it's a lot better than nothing. And actually, like 2 months ago, I think, you couldn't find ginger anywhere. Like, I would spend hours like walking around my neighborhood. I live in Yaffa, which is an old port city by the sea. I'd spend hours just walking around looking for ginger. No one had it. And you would ask everyone, like, oh, do you have ginger? And they would just say huthim, which is huthis in Hebrew. I guess like the ginger shipments got held up. So actually, this dish, what makes it so special is you use this very dark, thick, gooey soy sauce. To be honest, it looks like medicine, and it's what really makes this dish special. And I was contemplating whether or not I should use it, because I bring it from Singapore, and I have just, I think, enough for like one or two more serving sizes of it. I don't know if this is the time to use it or not, just because I know that I don't know when I'm going to Singapore next, and it's a little scary to put myself in a situation where, like, okay, that's it, I no longer have it. It's almost even, like, more comfortable to, like, not use it and have it than to not have it. I don't know why that is. Oh, wow, this is really steaming. Hold on. Not long after the war started, the Houthis kind of started attacking cargo ships in the Red Sea, kind of in solidarity with Palestinians. And I mean, I know it's affected global kind of shipments, but here specifically, I think the only thing I've really noticed is the lack of certain produce. And very crucially to me personally is ginger, like, because I think when you live away from home, I think food becomes so important to feeling some connection to your home. And I think especially now, living through a war, covering a war that is just so emotional, and the pictures coming out of it every day are so just devastating. I think that making food, eating food, sharing food with loved ones has kind of become really important. And it's also become a little hard to enjoy, I think. There's also a certain level of guilt of, okay, poor me, I can't get ginger in my, you know, safe home. But you know what, I have a house, I have a bed, I can still eat food. But I'm so aware of the fact that, you know, so many people don't have that right now. But I'm also still having to find ways to take care of myself. So, yeah.
So I am aware that it might seem strange or even trivial to be talking about cooking and a lack of ginger when you're living so close to a war. But that sort of thing is what many of our colleagues deal with on a day-to-day basis. They cover disasters and wars, but life outside of reporting often goes on as normal. So I caught up with Shayna to hear what that's been like for her.
Hi, Shayna. Nice to meet you. This is the first time we're meeting. I've never had a chat with you. Where are you from?
Yes. So I am a Singaporean American living in, well, technically I live in Yafa, which is a seaside kind of ancient port city close to Tel Aviv. But I'm based in the Jerusalem Bureau for BBC Monitoring.
Can you describe what that's like and what your day-to-day routine used to be like before the October 7th attacks?
Yeah, so as a journalist for BBC Monitoring, I monitor media narratives. So how the media portrays certain things, what angles they're pushing, what narratives they're pushing, what they say. I think what they don't say is also quite interesting. The language they use to frame things. Is it the occupied West Bank? Is it Judea and Samaria? Stuff like that. So we did a lot of kind of media narratives. And I think when you look at what's happening in my patch, which is covering Israel and the Palestinian territories. So I did a lot of West Bank raids, for example. And the way that the Israeli media covers it, it's always like, oh, the army went in and they conducted a raid to root out terrorism, that there were terrorists that were killed. When you look at the Palestinian media, they don't usually mention the fact that the people who might have been killed were involved in terror activity. Sometimes they describe them as civilians. Sometimes they actually are civilians, which certainly isn't always reported by the Israeli media. And then if you look at the way that the armed groups report on things, or I guess kind of the way they put out messaging about things, it's also quite interesting. So I was doing a lot of that. I was also doing a lot of coverage on the very large judicial overhaul demonstrations in Israel. So on the eve of the war, the right-wing government in Israel was trying to push forward this very contentious plan to overhaul the judicial system and curb the powers of the Supreme Court. And there it's really interesting because you see Israeli media being extremely lively, very varied, full of debate, full of different political ideas and conversations. And then when it comes to the Palestinians, all of that goes away. And it's the army narrative is what happened for the most part. And that's about it. Looking at Palestinian media sources can also be a little bit challenging in the sense that in Gaza, you have Hamas controlling a good amount of the media there. So you have to be careful about not taking what they say at face value.
That's very interesting, Shayna. When you talk about this, it seems like, well, basically there is a lot of bias on both sides in the media. What kind of difficulties does that create for you in your job?
I think it's really challenging in the sense that there is certainly an overarching picture, but you have to go into every single day and every single story just without any assumptions. And a lot of it also comes down to just piecing together. This is what they said. This is what they said. Somewhere in between, we can figure out what happened. Unfortunately for me, that also means watching a lot of graphic videos because videos are the best way to kind of get a sense of what exactly happened. But that also, of course, takes a heavy toll when you watch the same video 6, 7, 8 times over and pause at every frame to see what you might be missing, what else there is to the story.
And how do you cope with that?
It's challenging, to be honest, just because I think something that is strange, and certainly I feel it in a much more significant way now, is the sense that what I do at work didn't really exist for most of the people I'm surrounded with in my normal life, in the sense that I do live in Israel. And I think once I leave the office, there's an understanding of, okay, that army raid that I might have covered today, the perception is so different. If there is even a perception that there was this army raid where I don't know how many people were killed, but certainly since 2022, the death toll in the West Bank has been at a record high. And I think that's been a huge focus of my reporting. So it's hard when you cover a lot of violence and then you don't feel that people are aware of that violence.
I will get to the wider
life experience in Jerusalem in a bit. But what I want to understand is that how has the media narrative changed since October 7th on both sides? What are the major changes that you see?
So I would say October 7th was basically a catalyst for a lot of the media tendencies we already saw prior to that. So Israeli media have continued to cover the war in a very partial and a very sanitized way. They don't report on the death toll in Gaza. They don't report on the civilian impact, the humanitarian crisis that's unfolding there, human rights groups, warnings of imminent famine. You don't see pictures of just the scale of the destruction. And what the army says, they kind of take at face value. So a really great example of this is any kind of disputed incident. So there was this famous incident, I think, was it in March or late February? It later became the Flower Massacre. Essentially, there were aid seekers waiting near Gaza City to get aid from a convoy truck, and over 100 people ended up being killed. Now, the Israeli army said that they had fired warning shots into the air and that people had been killed because they were trampled and there was panic at the scene. If you look at the way that Palestinian media reported on it, it was the Israeli army indiscriminately opening fire on people, whereas international media reports have found that the army did open fire on some capacity at some of the aid seekers. And this is just one small example. It's the tip of the iceberg of just the day-to-day kind of things that we see. And Israeli media have almost kind of intensified their maybe support for the army. So if you look at any news broadcast on the screen, there are just little logos, there are Israeli flags, little logos that say together we'll win, with God's help we'll win. Some very centrist and very large news outlets in Israel started actually using their social media accounts. They switched to English to put out kind of pro-Israel messaging, trying to spread awareness of what happened on October 7th, kind of pin the humanitarian crisis on Hamas. So we see a lot of that in Israeli media, and I think it is so clear in terms of the effect and how it shapes public perception, because people really aren't aware of what's happening. And I think it's rather strange to see people sitting in restaurants and bars in Tel Aviv, and an hour drive south, people are starving to death, and there isn't really that awareness. And I would say a lot of it is because of the way that the media has chosen not to report on it.
And what changes did you see in the Palestinian media?
So when you look kind of from the beginning at Palestinian media, they didn't really highlight on the civilian impact of Hamas's October 7th attack. A lot of it was focused on Israeli army bases. And even still today, you'll see in the headlines, they'll say Al-Aqsa Flood Day, 180, which is the name of the Hamas-led attack on Israel. So it's still through that lens. And they certainly highlight the impact of Israel's kind of airstrikes, how many people have died that day or been killed in Israeli airstrikes. They use kind of headline terms like the latest war crime, the latest massacre, genocide. So it's actually, I would say it's almost even similar to the Israeli media, but just kind of very opposite ends of just two sides really playing up how they have personally been impacted by this war. And what's really interesting is we've seen a real shift in terms of Hamas media. There were some initial restrictions on their media. So they used to have an official website where they put a lot of their official messages out. They even had a TV station. And due to restrictions, they actually moved a lot of their messaging to Telegram. And this is from the very beginning, they put out these very slick military style videos showing them engaged in combat with Israeli soldiers, supposedly from Israeli bases. They put out videos showing their drone capability and other kind of military weapons. And that has kind of continued, maybe the videos less so, though they still put those out. But the use of Telegram, the messaging app, has been a really significant change due to restrictions, and I think that is probably here to stay for now.
And Shana, tell me about the atmosphere in the office that you work. How are things? I can imagine it must be a very difficult time for everyone covering this war so close to where it's happening.
Yeah, it's certainly been really challenging. There has not been one person in the office who wasn't personally affected by what's going on. We also are quite close to some of our Gaza colleagues, so it was very difficult for many of us to be so concerned about what was going on for them. But I think October 7th as well, I mean, that's a day I will never, ever forget, just the sheer confusion of what was happening and trying to understand it and trying to report on it. And I think, you know, everyone has lost somebody in some capacity in the office. Those of us who live here, this is our day-to-day work, and this is also our day-to-day lives. And you can't really escape the story. We live the story. I mean, where I live, we haven't had rocket sirens in, I think, 2 or 3 months. But the first few months, it was multiple times a day. I lost people I knew. And I think that was like how it was for everyone. So it's been challenging.
Yeah, I can totally understand, Shana. And what happens when you leave the office, day-to-day life? Is the war in Gaza very apparent on the streets of Jerusalem? Is it a topic you talk about when you go out for dinner and socializing with your friends?
So I actually don't live in Jerusalem. I live in Yafa, which is connected to Tel Aviv. So what's quite interesting that I feel I've noticed is that Tel Aviv has kind of become the hub of kind of like the hostages and where the protests are staged. So you see a lot of pictures of hostages hung up all over Tel Aviv, yellow ribbons kind of signifying the call to bring them home. And then I feel actually in Jerusalem, there's a bit less of that. So it's really interesting. I'll leave the office and then I'll take the train to Tel Aviv. And I get off right where what's called hostage square is. And every single day there are hostage families protesting in front of the Israeli army headquarters for a deal to bring home the hostages immediately. And then kind of very soon after that, I enter more into the city and everything is relatively normal. And I find that so strange. I can't quite grasp that kind of a huge gap in between, you know, what I covered that day at work, which might have been, I don't know, Israeli airstrike on an aid convoy in Gaza and trying to figure out what happened, like that strike on the World Central Aid kitchen workers where 7 aid workers were killed. And then, you know, I go from that to Hostage Square and I see these families so desperately stopping traffic and holding up signs that say help. You can really feel how they are just doing anything and everything they can because they feel so abandoned by their government. And then I go into Tel Aviv and people are sitting in bars and restaurants and having normal conversations. And that's where it really hits me of just how much of a discrepancy there is in all of this and how separate all of it is. It's pretty incredible to see that separation, especially in the way that this war has played out, because there isn't access to Gaza by journalists. We have these young people taking their phones and kind of live streaming what's happening to them on social media. And it feels like the people who are right next door, whose government this is kind of, you know, happening on behalf of, just kind of have no idea.
So Shana, I know that there are Palestinians who live in Jerusalem as well. And recently there were videos of the Jewish community giving food for Ramadan to the Palestinian community. Do you feel that there is this sense of bonding and reconciliation somewhere in the horizon?
It certainly exists. It's very minimal, but when you see it, it's beautiful and it's special. And I think there are people who might pass out treats for Ramadan and Eid, Jewish activists, Christian activists, and there are also Israeli activists who are very opposed to what is happening in Gaza. And they have made a huge point of demonstrating what's happening in Gaza. There are quite a few groups that go out on a regular basis, and they'll put pictures of the destruction of Gaza up in public, and it's not necessarily met with a lot of friendly smiles, but that takes a lot of courage. And there have been a lot of grassroots movements that existed before October 7th that have continued to do powerful work to build bridges between Israelis and Palestinians for some kind of fostered and shared future. Whether or not that's feasible in the horizon is another question, but there are people who have continued to fight for it. There are people who have also, their desire to fight for it has been strengthened. There's also people whose desire for it has kind of come to a standstill after October 7th.
Thank you, Shayna Oppenheimer, for talking to me. You can find out more about her work in the upcoming spring edition of Monitor, the BBC Monitoring magazine. Sign up for their latest updates at monitoring.bbc.co.uk. This is the documentary from the BBC World Service.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
I'm Farhana Khamidi and this is The Fifth Floor. Now, have a listen to this.
El perro de San Roque no tiene rabo, porque Ramón Ramírez se lo ha cortado.
This is Alicia Hernandez from BBC Mundo, and she thinks that this popular Spanish tongue twister can help us understand a little unknown part of history. Alicia has been looking at how her mother tongue, Spanish, is being spoken in Equatorial Guinea, the only African country which has Spanish as one of its official languages.
I think that Equatorial Guinea is a very forgotten part of Spanish history. Equatorial Guinea was one of the last countries that became independent from Spain in 1968. And I think that in Spain, we don't know a lot about it. Equatorial Guinea, or we say in Spanish, Guinea Equatorial, is on the coast of West Africa, but it has two parts. One part is continental, and the other part is made up of five islands. In 1471, Fernando Po, that was a Portuguese traveler, was searching for a new route to India. He went to this part of the coast of West Africa and used the main island of the actual Equatorial Guinea as a port that they mainly used for slave trafficking. After that, in 1777, Portugal and Spain made a treaty and they exchanged lands. Spain gave to Portugal a part of the actual Brazil, and Portugal gave to Spain the actual Equatorial Guinea. When I talk with Equatorial Guineans in Spanish, there are several differences. For example, they pronounce the R, R in a different way. For example, I say the word dog, perro, and they said, for example, perro. I ask one of the interviewed to say a famous Spanish tongue twister. And it's, el perro de San Roque no tiene rabo porque Ramón Ramírez se lo ha cortado. And she sounds like Ortiz.
El perro de San Roque no tenía rabo porque Ramón Ramírez se lo ha cortado.
Okay, in English is, the dog of Saint Roque doesn't have a tail because Ramón Ramírez has cut it off. But my favorite word is aguacate, avocado, but it's not the fruit. In Equatorial Guinea, they say aguacate to refer to hair extensions. The origin of this word is very curious because there is a street in Madrid, Calle del Aguacate, Avocado Street, where Equatorial Guinean women went to buy hair extensions. So the name of the street became the name of the hair extensions. There is another word that is chapear. Chapear sounds like a Spanish verb, but it doesn't come from Spanish. It comes from the English word to chop. And actually, it means to chop. Another interesting word that I record when I was doing this article was caminante. The sentence is, I want a caminante. Quiero un caminante is, I want a whiskey. And the word caminante came from Johnny Walker, because Walker in Spanish is caminante, a person who walks.
Alicia Hernandez there from BBC Mundo. Is there an unusual word or expression in your language? Let us know. We'll try to find out more about it with the help of our amazing international colleagues. Send us an email to thefifthfloor@bbc.co.uk. That's thefifthfloor, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. I'm Farhana Khamidi, and the Fifth Floor team this week was Caroline Ferguson and Alice Joya. The sound engineer was Neva Misirian. You've been listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service.